Welcome to How'd We Get Here, a podcast on education and design with wellness in mind. I'm Mark Anthony, and on today's episode, we'll speak to Dr. Christopher Alexander, professor of video games and design, as we discuss his educational experiences and also the lens in which he views being one of the only ones in the field of his study and career. All right, Chris, so it's been a while. How have you been, man?
I've been fantastic, man. How are you doing?
I'm good. How's isolation been treating you?
It's been all right, you know, coping, doing a lot of digital things to keep the sanity, recording and building video games and interactive experiences. You know, it's sometimes it's nice for creatives to get bottled up for a bit to get sometimes put those ideas out.
Yeah, I could tell because everywhere I go online, I see you. I see your face pop up. I'm like, what is this? I go, I know this guy. I love that it's a parent series that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. It's my wife's brainchild and my front camera execution.
Yeah.
We saw a need. Well, you know, what has happened since the pandemic, a lot of people have been approaching me about what should I play with my kids and what are nonviolent video games? And my wife kept on hearing all these questions. And she was like, yo, why don't we just put together a series that just tackles this so you can just answer them. And then you can point people towards those videos. I was like, that is why I married you. So we started recording the show and it's gaining some steam. We have another season coming up shortly. I guess I could talk about it. It's called It's a Parent Reading. And so I'm going to be reading various children's books, specifically the ones that I read to my kids about empowerment and being different, you know, stuff that they're likely not able, I can say able now, to tackle in the classroom, but traditionally weren't. So trying to provide reading time, circle time for parents via the next season of It's a Parent.
Yeah, you're just keeping steady in that video content space now, which is good. I want to thank you for speaking to me today about your experiences coming up in the industry where people like us are few and far between. I really wanted to reach out to people in my circles and beyond to get their thoughts on how they got to this point in their life, regardless of the barriers set in front of them. I also know that there are other students out there that feel as though they are one of one when they step into my class. So whether that's being a student of color, women in tech, web development or game design, indigenous students, students who identify as LGBTQ, different cultural backgrounds, ethnic groups, or all of the above, for them, they just don't feel represented or feel as though the real world might not be so different from the world they experience now. My hope is that this will help those students, designers or coworkers, even friends, know that they're not alone in this space. There are people like you out there doing amazing things and they've lived and shared parts of your story. So I'm excited to hear from you today. And there's so much for us to get caught up on. But first, do you want to maybe give everyone listening maybe a quick introduction of who you are and what you do professionally?
Well, okay. First of all, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. We were previously co-workers together and we shared some stories in the past. So it's an honor to be here on your platform. My name is Dr. Christopher Alexander. I'm known as the professor of video games. I specialize in video game design, video games broadcasting that includes virtual studio production, and esports infrastructure. And what that means is how we get post-secondary institutions to start integrating esports and video games curriculum at the infrastructure level. That means through programs and initiatives that students need and are looking forward to. So that's a brief introduction. I guess I've been involved with video games for, 30 years now as a player, as a globally ranked player into video games, and then now as a professor. I live and breathe video games. They've saved me. They've protected me. They've helped me. And I'm sure we're going to get into a lot of that today.
So like, even for me, like coming up, you know, my friends and I were into video games, of course. I remember playing Spy Hunter on the Commodore 64. My cousin and I had the Atari when we were growing up. So we played Pole Position and Asteroids Heavy.
Okay. You know?
And then, of course, we went into things like, you know, Nintendo, Sega Master System, setting up LANs in our basement, playing Duke Nukem with neighbors, you know, and now it's to the point where like even I'm building custom desktops with my son for gaming, you know what I mean? But like back then, I'm not sure being a creator or designer of video games as a profession was even a thought. Like, it was just seen as a hobby or a pastime to us. Like maybe because our parents didn't understand it. So like, what I want to know is like, who or what inspired you to take this path towards a career in video games?
Wow. So I would have to say that the greatest inspiration towards this path would be my parents. They allowed me to immerse myself in video games and immerse myself in music and audio production. And it was interesting, to answer your question, when my dad came to my defense in Montreal, he watched my successful defense. And at the end, I said to him, "Yo, Dad, how come you never had a problem with me playing as much video games as I did?" And this is what this guy said to me. He said, "Son, the reason why I was okay with you playing as many video games as you were is because I knew when I turned on the news that you weren't going to be there." And I say, "Yo, this guy, he chest played me, man. He was real. Like, yo, I knew you were passionate about it, but I knew it was a place where you could stay and be safe. And a lot of your emotions would go there." So, you know, and my mom was there the entire time too, right? So I would say that they gave me the start because they allowed me to explore my passion. If you're passionate about something, try to become an expert in that thing and you can make it lucrative for yourself. And they also said, both of them, it's more important to be about it than it is to talk about it. So that's why, like, I haven't really, it's only now that people are watching my replays of playing Street Fighter and Lightseekers and now even Legends of Runeterra, like, yo, what, this guy, he plays like he loves games. Yeah, I love games. So yeah, that's my long-winded answer to your question.
Yeah, no, but that's good though, because I think, like, you know, when you're coming up during that time that we came up in, like early 80s, or I call myself an 80s baby, even though I'm born in 79, right? Like, those are times when a lot of things are new in tech, where our parents just didn't even understand it. You know what I mean? So to see you playing video games or like me on a computer, like, they don't really know what that is. They just kind of think it's a phase. It's just a hobby. You know, it's not a real profession or something that they can maybe like make a living off of. But, you know, what your dad says is something I even found myself saying about our son is like, yo, at least he's like, he's 15. At least he's not on the street.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's a totally different sort of mindset to have as a parent for you to encourage something that you may not understand, but you know it's actually keeping your family safe or your kids safe.
Yeah. And to that end, when I wanted to get into video games at 14, I had to get a job in order to pay for Killer Instinct on the Super Nintendo Entertainment System. I got my dad to go to Dominion. What was it called again? No, Consumer Distributing. That was it. That was
Okay. Yeah. I remember that.
I was looking at the catalog. Yo, your boy. Anyway, but he also said, listen, if you're passionate about something like music making, why don't you build your own machine? I was like, build my own machine. He's like, yo, it's going to be cheaper. So I'm listening to you talk about building computers with your son. And although my dad didn't know how to build, he knew that you could build. And he was like, listen, to keep your costs down, son, you should learn how to build your own machine. So I just went and I talked to my peers at work. I don't know, my boy, Petrick, he helped me out to help me craft my first machine. And then I fell in love with it. And so there's two sides of it that I learned from my parents. That is passion. And the second thing is process. Learning that it's going to take some kind of step to get there. And that's why, like, in this current age of everybody wanting instant everything, sometimes it's incredible to see when people realize, hold on a second, when I put in the reps, success, it's eventually going to come. It's not a matter of if, it's when. But if you're banking on some kind of short, quick thing, it's more of an asterisk, like, oh, maybe it will, maybe it won't, you know?
Yeah. Like I say, like, never cut the process for the progress. You know, you have to actually put in the work to get to where you want to be, right? So did you always plan on this being your career path in video games or even teaching?
So I guess the genesis of it all was I wasn't doing too well in school at post-secondary. So I was at Ryerson actually as a student. And first and second year, I wasn't doing too well in school. And third year came about and I noticed that many of my teachers were posting their notes as PDFs online. At that time, we lived in the suburbs and it was a 2-hour commute each way, each day. And I was like, man, if I could find some way to listen to my notes, I'm sure I could do better than sitting and reading it. Because most people don't know this. I'm a classically trained pianist and I can't read notes. I play by ear. Like I can listen to it pretty much almost congruently. I thought it was perfect pitch, but now they call it some relative pitch, something like this. So it's not the perfect one, but it's close enough. Mm-hmm. And so I found this program called Text Aloud.
Oh, yeah.
I purchased it and it takes raw text and converts it into an MP3 file. Now, as you now know, I used to make a lot of music. So what I would do is I would slap this robotic voice on top of my instrumentals. And for 2 hours, I'd be listening to my notes on the way to school. Suddenly, in the classroom, I'm answering all kinds of questions. And I was like, wait a second. Maybe this is the way that I learn. I said, hold on a second. I'm also all right at these sound memory games inside of video games. But yo, somebody programmed that. I said, hold on a second. Maybe video games can possess the keys for engagement in the classroom because not everybody. And so that's why I started diving into it. Then I started the PhD to learn about there are three layers to interactivity, and it's text, audio, and video. But then in my dissertation, I was like, yo, but video games, they add an additional layer. That's interactivity. And in any study where you had two or more ways of consuming information, text, audio, video, and interactivity, the one that I added at the end, learning gains were higher. So I was like, wait a second, is that the draw of video games, that we're constantly learning? And now I would say there's nothing you can do in a video game without learning something. And it's because of that engagement, like developers know, listen, instead of saying health power, we put HP, they'll figure it out. And the reason why people are able to game for so long is because there's no, what I've learned about cognitive overload. They're not putting too much text or too much audio or too much video at the same time. It's the perfect balance. I'm like, wait a second. Aren't all classrooms trying to engage via multimedia? Well, then there's something we can learn from video games outside of fun. And so I started exploring that. And thankfully, because I was obsessed with video games, I don't feel like I'm making it up. I'm like, listen, I've been putting in hours. I know that I'm engaged. I know that I don't get fatigued. But I've been sitting in some classrooms where humans are cutting and pasting notes into a PowerPoint presentation. And I started nodding off. I was feeling bad about myself until I read about cognitive overload. And I found out that on PowerPoint slides, if you're putting more than, I think it's between 28 and 35 characters on a slide, that you might start overloading humans. And I was like, wow, video games don't do that. And I was so anyways, that's a long-winded answer. I it was a passion that I started to realize why I was passionate about it. And now it's transitioned into a career. I'm also developing games myself. So it's like, yeah, video games, they hold the keys for engagement. And when I tell people this, they always bring up the negative stuff about video games. When I talk to them about cognition and retention and learning and working memory, they're like, huh? That stuff happens in video games? I'm like, of course. You know how much finite math is in League of Legends? In calculating how much damage your opponent has? People aren't even looking at these things yet, except there are a couple of organizations that I work with closely that are. And this, to me, they hold the keys for both engagement and entertainment and education. Like, once we start teasing these things apart, because the physics that are used inside of League of Legends are the same real world physics, often with some modifications. I would also say that socially, a lot of gamers are incredible problem solvers because they're used to troubleshooting. They're used to figuring out in specific environments, but they're used to also being able to try and try again until they get it right. But they're also used to having some kind of objectives list to hit, to know that once I get to this level, I'm platinum ranked. It means I got to work really hard to get there. But these types of things that I just mentioned are what I talk about we should be considering integrating into education so that there's that same transparency that they're seeing in video games in the classroom. What does it take to get an A? How many vertices do I need to draw in order for it to consider? And of course, you'd have to weight it. All right, somebody that's doing 70,000 vertices is going to get an A. Well, then at least people know. And it's not arbitrary and they can work toward it.
It's just even now, like that we're doing this whole like online learning, you know, I find that I'm also, or I did when we started, you know, when we were just wrapping up the winter semester, is that I gave them options. There was video, there was the textual side of it. There was all these, I think I gave them like three different options to learn the same material. Mm-hmm. Right. And you found that, or I found that students came back saying things like, you know, thank you, Mark, for all of this, you know, information because it's really helping me understand the concepts better. Like the video, like you said, I can pause, I can rewind, I can have it as a reference tool. But then even the text base, I can go over that at my own pace if I need to.
So the common variable between the scenario that I gave you and what you're already implementing in the classroom is your first statement when you said, I grew up with video games, which leads me to a very interesting statistic that I've uncovered in my research. In Canada, the average age of the post-secondary faculty member, that is somebody who can make infrastructural decisions and curricular decisions and, you know, running particular things when it comes to education, is 51 years of age. Now, the average age of the video game player, I think it's since shifted. It used to be between 35 and 38. And I think now it's like 40 and 40. Well, obviously, we're growing up. But you can see just in that statistic what happens if you didn't grow up with video games. And I'm explaining to you that video games hold the keys to how we can educate the population sitting in our seats who absolutely statistically is playing video games. Like, how, what happens if you didn't grow up with video games? Well, that's a research paper. Like, how do you explain to a human that 20,000 people are watching one person in their basement play League of Legends right now? I'm not even looking at Twitch, but I'm telling you that that's what's happening right now. And I'm fairly confident that it's happening, but how do you explain that? And also explain that there are physics in that game, and also explain that there's finite math in that game, and also explain that there's socialization going on in that game. That's a lot, yo. That's a lot for one thing. You can't say the same thing about other media. You can't. So it's like, whoa, hold on. So people are watching one person in their basement play a video game. Some of them are donating. They're learning about physics and socialization skills, and they're having fun. How is this possible? That's actually mind blowing that I just said that, but that's a real world. That's a real world scenario right now.
Yeah. Cause that's what everybody shoots for in the classroom too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, exactly. So like, honestly, obviously I can hear your passion about games coming through right now. Right. And you spoke about, you know, later on, you kind of actually talked about at the university level, how you sort of discovered that this was sort of your thing to go into, right? But like, in a sense, what I'm getting is like video games was like your calling, right? Like you even had support from your parents. It's sort of like what the Japanese call your ikigai, right? I'm not sure if you've heard of that, but it's basically like your purpose of being, like something that takes you into your flow state, right? Like it was something you were good at, and your love for video games became your mission. And it made you realize that within them, there was something that you experienced while playing them that you felt the world needed to experience. And not many of us can bridge that into a profession where we can get paid to be able to be in a constant state of our own flow. So like earlier on, before university, were you even aware that there was a possibility that this might be your profession? Like, were there any professionals in the space that you aspired to be at a younger age? Like, how did you even get started in pursuing video games as a career path? Like, how did high school, elementary, like, prepare you to even go into university? Like, because, you know, like I said, I didn't even know it was an option to even get into as far as design. Even for me, before you answer, like, even for me going into graphic design, I wasn't even aware of that being an actual option as my career. Like, I knew I had people like I would look up to, you know, like the George Olsons, Gail Andersons, but like, I didn't even know I could actually study that. I didn't know what it was called. Like, if someone told me, Mark, you want to study art? It was like fine art. It was traditional art. It wasn't like digital art, right? So like, how did, and even when I got to college and university, I saw kids that were far and beyond ahead of me in terms of computer programming and things like that, because they had access to that in high school. I'm wondering, did you have access to those things in high school, or was it purely like your dad kind of supported you, or your mom and dad supported you in building those things to let you be immersed in it as you're growing up?
So I remember in high school, I had saved up enough money on October 9th, 1999 to purchase the Sega Dreamcast.
Yeah.
And yo, changed my life though. And I'll tell you why. They had the little, first of all, it was the
portable
ahead of its time, like portable, like the VMU. Anyway, first console with internet connectivity. Anyways, a disk file size larger than 700. And that's a point of debate and discussion. Anyway, so in high school, I was obsessed with playing games. They were the place that I went when others were making fun of me. You know, we'll get into that. It was a place that I would go, but I was in this communications technology class, Comtech, and my professor, Mr. Bartu, I'll never forget, and Mr. Trapp, rest in peace. They showed me video editing, and all I would do obsessively, I would cut the FM, the videos from the Sega Dreamcast cutscenes, and I'd splice them on top of music songs. Like, I was so excited. I remember cutting Sonic Adventure on top of, I think, Ghetto Superstar with Mariah Carey and ODB. Like, I remember I was that connected to video games in a way that, I'm just going to integrate this into whatever I'm doing because that's what I'm doing. And I started playing against people in Tetris, like on the green Game Boy, battling people at lunch and stuff. And people were like, this guy's pretty good. I ended up doing a raffle one time where I would give away an entire cake if somebody could defeat any of my ghosts in Mario Kart 64. And I knew it. I was so confident, like, I'm going to eat this cake. And I did. Anyway, so it was sort of there the entire time. And to get back to your point of who I looked up to, but the game that I was globally ranked in, Street Fighter III, Third Strike, greatest fighting game of all time, in my opinion, because it was about learning your opponent and showing them that you're learning them in real time. More on that in the eventual autobiography where I talk about Street Fighter as a metaphor for life. More on that later. And so we had this scenario now where I'm playing a lot of video games. I start to see Victor, who many people know as Team Spooky, and I start to see Mike Ross and Gutex. These guys are out there playing video games and being on camera at the same time. I'm like, yo, these guys are incredible. I start seeing IFC Yipes. And I'm like, man, these guys are so, I start seeing Pi Sai and Pi Smug. And I'm starting to see these guys come up who look like me and play like me. And I'm like, okay, I'm seeing them do it and we'll get into it. But really, life is about mirrors. And sometimes mirrors is about light and not necessarily about color. But half of the people that I mentioned in that scenario there, they do look like me. So they're actual mirrors. And so I just saw possibility. I'm like, yo, these guys are actively engaging humans via what I love. And I know they love it too, because I'm obsessively listening and hanging on their every word. Okay, this is a thing. And I remember one time in class, I had problems with paying attention in particular classrooms. And the way that I coped was by playing video games. So that one part of my brain was stimulated and the sound part, which I told you I learned, could take in the information. I remember one class, I was playing Zelda the Minish Cap on the Game Boy Advance. And I was fully listening, attentive in class, playing the game. And the teacher just stopped the class and called me out. He says, sir, you can't play games in my class. I'm like, sir, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to. I thought I was being quiet back here, which I was. But this is my way of listening. I would like to just, can we just continue with the lesson, please? And he said, no, I don't want you playing. Now, remember, laptops are trending in classrooms right now. And at that time, I knew that was going to be the case, but whatever. So
yeah. So is this university or this is high school?
This is university now.
Okay.
Right? And I said, sir, this is how I learn. This is how I pay attention. He was like, no, I don't want you playing games in this class. I said, sir, can we please not do this? And he says, no. And so then I pause my game and I look at him and I say, sir, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to put this Game Boy on the table. I'm going to repeat your last two sentences word for word, and I'm going to pick up this Game Boy and I'm going to keep playing. And then he says to me in front of the class, I don't think you can do that. And then the whole class goes, ooh. So I paused Minish Cap, which you can't, you just go to the menu. I place the Game Boy on top of the table. I repeat his last two sentences word for word. I pick up my Game Boy and I keep playing. And you know what he said? Carry on. And one of my idols, who ended up being my mentor and my supervisor at Ryerson, Dana Lee, I would wake up and make it into his television technical theory class at 8:30 in the morning, always playing Tetris in the class. I would be listening to him attentively. I'd raise my hand while playing Tetris. He would call on me and I would answer his question while playing. That guy, he got it. And when that first teacher initially started battling me, and Dana respected me, he respected my way of learning, and he later supervised me, rest in peace as well, I knew there was something there. And I also knew, and this is kind of a thing for me in life anyways, whenever there's pushback and people say to me, that's not possible, it actually tells me that it is.
That it is, yeah. Same. Yeah, no, I agree. I've heard that before.
Yeah, you know, so when they're like video games, when I heard a couple of times, video games, they're not going to be as popular as you think. I'm like, okay, that means that it is. So yeah, long-winded answer, but yeah, that's sort of the trajectory from elementary, high school, over to university, and then wanting to delve into academia. I wanted to get into media production, you know, but it wasn't my time yet. And so I went the academia route. I went the substantiation route. I wanted to stop just protesting, saying, yo, Street Fighter is awesome and we should do this in the classroom. Because if you're talking to a human that doesn't play video games, it doesn't make sense. But now with my research, I'm like, listen, overwhelmingly, these students play these games from these departments. What are you planning on doing with this information? It's a very different conversation. You can't say, well, it's League of Legends. No. Here's the statistics from your specific demographic. What do you plan on doing? And if there is nothing, please let me help you. It's a very different conversation now, right? And it's refreshing to see that people at least are putting some kind of a shield down, because the pandemic has forced humans to look at this realm of video games and realize, wait, just like with racism, not all games are bad. Not all games can do foul things. So what about the ones that aren't? What about the ones that don't make the news? What about games like Virginia and Black Sad that tackle issues of race, which I use in the classroom, that many people don't even know about? What about those games? You know?
So and those are important things to show now, especially like what we're going through at this particular moment, right?
Yeah, but also that I've been doing that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, no, I get it.
And so it's like it's interesting now that ears are opening more. I'm not even saying open. I'm saying they're opening more.
Yeah. No, like you brought up some good points there. Like, and that sort of leads into my next question that, you know, maybe you've answered a little bit about it, but like while you're going through school and you're sort of, in a way, like you said, protesting, but you're challenging the fact that these video games here help people learn, specifically you. It doesn't distract or doesn't take away from your cognitive ability, or even it enhances your cognitive ability, possibly in some ways. Mm. Were there any challenges or obstacles, setbacks that you faced kind of being the only one like yourself as you enter the profession? Like, how did your classrooms look? Like, was there anyone like you when you got into the industry or even in education? Like, and even now, are there many visible minorities in the gaming industry or in your university classrooms right now?
So I guess the most recent heartwarming tale would be from my Concepts of Narrative class this past year. I don't know if Bo would be familiar with or comfortable with me outing him, but he's an amazing dude. And I remember standing at the front of the class. He walks into the classroom. He turns. He looks at me with such shock. He turns to his boy and says, yo, our professor is black. And I smiled and I laughed so hard. At the break, he came up to me and he was like, sir, I just wanted to apologize. I said, what could you possibly be apologizing for? It's like, well, I think you heard what I said to my buddy. I said, what you saw in my face was honor. I was so honored that you said that, because I didn't have a chance to react in that same way when I was in your position. And he was like, oh, interesting. So classrooms are changing. Academia is changing. I've been able and fortunate enough to find mirrors along the way. And when I did my PhD, one of my great friends, Tisha Thomas, she is an incredible human being. And she actually now works as a hardcore researcher for the CRTC. And we did our PhDs together. So there were mirrors the entire time there. We worked on research projects together. So, you know, there are more ones around now.
Yeah.
That it can heal your sanity. Like we're talking right now. Like, you know
That's
what I mean?
We're yeah.
in the same department at the same time. And there were two of us, two ones, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember when you came on board, I was so excited and you saw it in my face and you didn't even have to ask why. I was like, I know why this guy is excited. And we didn't even share the tales of who we were yet. I'm so happy you're here. Let's see. I'm pretty sure that's one of the first things I said to you.
Yeah.
And what I was saying to you was, I'm so happy you're here. But for all the other reasons that people are now aware of.
I know, right? That's the thing. Like it's a bit, like you said, the whole mirror thing. Like there is so much in seeing yourself being reflected somewhere and represented,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. like I said, I've been teaching for almost 13 years now. Mm-hmm. And like, I could tell you, like, there hasn't been a lot of people who share same cultural background or whatever it is mm-hmm. as me to mm-hmm. where sometimes I did like just feel alone or people didn't understand me. But now I think like you just said, like classrooms are changing. Like I'm seeing a lot of my students even just asking for that representation. Like yeah. I recall like a student coming up to me, meeting me for an office hours to like review his work and him just saying like, you know, I value your opinion because there's not, you know, people who look like me in the classroom or even mm-hmm. behind the podium. And in a way, I'll tell you like that hit me like very hard. But like you said, I felt honored at the same time. Like mm-hmm. I felt privileged in him trusting and believing in him. Yeah, because he knew like, he's like, this person will get where I'm coming from. But it also mm. told me that there were people who didn't know where he was coming from. Mm. And that may have affected his success in the classroom and also written his story as he exited the classroom.
Mm. So that I get, and I like that story. But again, in my own experience, that's where video games again came in to save me. Because I can tell you incredible stories about harassment at work and people trying to, you know, paint me in a particular light. And there are stories in video games that mimic my exact experiences that I would go home and play. Right now, I'm thinking about Final Fantasy Tactics and a character named Ramza, and I don't want to spoil the game, but what he goes through is almost congruent with what was happening to me at my job at the time, which when I was fighting through a whole bunch of enemies that were all mythical and mysterious in my head, I was like, yo, I'm gonna get out of this one too, because Ramza did, you know? And that was a place where I would go. That's where I could put those emotions. And I know somebody's going to hear this interview and be like, yo, my man dropped Ramza in Tactics. And they're going to be like, yo, this is exactly what I did. Or when I was feeling a specific way and I was playing Mirror's Edge. And Faith, to me, she was like, man, there's so much congruence between what she's going through and what I was going through in a different job. That playing Mirror's Edge to me was very emotional because I was like, man, these bullets that are coming at me right now are making me really sad inside because I'm not seeing these as bullets. I'm seeing these as the kind of foul things that I know humans are saying about me in the workplace. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But yo, fake it through it. I can tell by these cutscenes. So yo, I'm going to get through it too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's one of those things where I know if you're feeling in a particular way, there is a game that you can go to now. It's like books, man. There's a place for you to go and put that emotion and find some kind of mirror. Really all we need is some kind of mirror. It doesn't matter if it's digital, but what matters is that there's a mirror there to see a reflection of self in some kind of way. And so, yeah, I don't know, man, video games, I'm even getting into it. Like I sort of sidetracked your question about, you know, sorry.
No, it's on point. Like, what are your thoughts or your practices on inclusion and representation of Black, Indigenous, people of color in game design or in your classroom, LGBTQ? I know you've touched on that a little bit about the games that you show in your class that you've been showing, right? Mm-hmm. But even mm-hmm. now, like there's a lot of talk about, you know, having or implementing universal design and inclusion in the classroom and having people have their voice. And again, these are things that I've always sort of done because I come from that, right? So I don't see anyone else as beneath me or above me. I kind of relate to them no matter what they are, even if I don't identify as them, as a particular cultural group. The part that I share is knowing that there is a sort of feeling of, you know, I'm unheard, or I don't have a voice, or I don't have perspective. So I try to give that in my classroom in a variety of different ways. I'm just wondering, like, is there other avenues that other educators who maybe not, you know, teach video games particularly, but we all do use multimedia in our classrooms. Is there some ways that we can start to make students feel like they are a part of the subject matter or include them in some way?
Let me tell you a secret. And at the beginning of almost every single class that I teach in video games, I run a survey.
Same here.
And I ask students what games they play. And I can tell because of many of the games I've played, I could kind of suss out an angle of reflection. And those are the games, when I download what it is they play, I can make suggestions in the classroom when I show them games. They're like, yo, I didn't even know this game exists. For example, a game that we played in class, which was incredible, is a game called Sayonara Wild Hearts, okay? Which, when the game starts up and people listen to the narrator, I heard somebody scream out, hey, yo, is that Queen Latifah? I'm like, yes, that's right. She narrates it. I say things like, we played a game called Neo Cab. And we played, I told you about Black Sad and about Virginia. To answer your question, the way that I include is by including.
Okay. That's simple enough.
And I say to the students, listen, I want to tailor this class to you. Tell me through your experiences of what you have enjoyed from a video game standpoint. Tell me that experience that says to you, ooh, I love this game. And then I look at it. I ask them to put a link to it. I'll ask them to put a link to gameplay of the video just in case I haven't played it, which it rarely happens, but in some cases it does. So I can include them by learning about what they enjoy. And for some reason, people walk out saying, oh man, I feel like you picked that game for me. And I just put up my hands. I was like, well, you told me what you wanted, didn't you? And I love doing that because it allows me to stay on my feet. And sometimes I change the direction of the classroom, to use a character move from Street Fighter IV. That's Abel. Change of direction, a quarter circle forward punch. Anyway, so I would do these things to help myself understand how I need to grow, right? As well as providing resources in addition to gathering what it is the students want, what they say they want, you know, within the context of what I'm trying to teach, right? What my favorite part of teaching in this realm is, a student will come up to me at the end of class and accuse me. They will say, yo, Chris, I've seen your Steam library as we play through this class. I listen to you talk about the games you like. Play this game, you're going to like it. When a student accuses me of what they know I'm going to like, and I download the game and I come back next week saying, yo, you were right, that's where I know there's that connection. You know what I mean? That's when I know there's two-way mirrors here. I see them and they see me, and we're trying to teach each other. You know what I mean? I'm trying to upgrade your design skills. I'm trying to upgrade your narration skills. But yo, you upgrade me as a human being, teaching me more about what I love, and it looks like you love because you're here to learn about it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that's a big part of learning too, I find now, is having those connections with your students, that relatability. Mm-hmm. Because then, once you have that connection and relationship, now you can start to have empathy for them. And then after empathy comes encouragement, because you kind of know their story, and then you're invested on seeing them succeed. Without that, you might not be able to help students in the way that they need to travel their own path. You're basically going to put them on your path or what you feel they need, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than sort of supporting their own ideas or their own goals in life. And that sort of leads me to like one of my last questions, which is, you know, people going back and talking about the effects of streaming kids in high school. and specifically toward children of color or underserved communities. And they're finding that like the graduation rates are of course lower for the applied stream. And also that almost 80% of kids who are in the applied stream in high school don't even end up applying to post-secondary education. So for me, like if that's the sort of pattern that we're seeing, I'm seeing that reflected in my classroom. And I'm wondering, like, do you see that reflected in your classroom as well?
There's nobody talking about this. Who else is going in front of, okay, so this is a long-winded answer to your question. Oh, I should let you finish the question first because I'm ready.
No, but but like what I'm saying is that on one end, you have students being streamed into this applied stream, which thinks that these are hands-on things. Obviously, we've talked about, and what I'm getting from this is that people learn in different ways, right? Yep. So they might not be the advanced academia route. They might learn in different ways, exactly, which a teacher in a high school or a counselor may deem as being applied more hands-on. They send them down the hands-on route, which for some of us are the arts, right? Which most of these kids are interested in. But then when they get to college and think that, okay, I'm going to do art or design or music production or gaming, now they're thrown these things like finite physics, all these different things that are higher order academia or academic route that they didn't get in high school. And now they're set back.
Yeah.
So now they're again, the imposter in the classroom where others who have come the academic route and just said, now you have the option of doing whatever you want at the university or college level. They're actually more prepared than those who went the applied stream.
Right? In high school, grade 9, I got a 55 in math. In grade 10, I got a 54. In grade 11, you guessed it, I got a 53. In grade 12, I was going to fail. Now, there is a human being on this planet who I've had the pleasure to just saying hello to, but I need to talk down and talk to him and thank him. His name is Peter Alfano. He brought me in after classroom hours and he said, Chris, you're going to fail this class. Like, but here's the thing. I believe in you. So I'm going to pass you through this class, but quote, don't let me regret this decision. And I said, no, sir. So here's what happened. We were under this fortunate system where we had a grade 13, which at the time was called OAC. In grade 13 or OAC, I cut math out of my curriculum, made the honor roll, and then was able to get into university. Now, picture me going through university in third year, figuring out that I could listen to my notes, and then going on to do a PhD in research methods where I had to do incredible statistics and mathematics to getting 98% in statistics and math courses. Now, technically, if I'm terrible, 55, 54, 53, 52, fail, take a chance, he could see it. It means that at that time, the way that I was learning math wasn't jiving with me. For example, this is the lesson that I often give in the classroom. I say, in the first year of my math class, if my teacher had put up a single slide that had a screen capture from Street Fighter II Champion Edition, down or up, LYB, XY. Anyway, XA. And there was a list of all the different math skills inside of that one screenshot, the projectile, the velocity, the speed, the calculation between the distance between the players. All of these things were listed just on a static image. I likely could have been a mathematician. Because I was playing so much Street Fighter at the time. I knew frame data. I knew about cooldown times. I knew about buffering inputs. I knew about all of those things in high school, but that's not what was happening in the classroom. Yeah. So now we have this transformation here, which I think is a positive thing. When we're doing intake, and that is students submit papers, they are able to have portfolios. And in this year, we did do in-person interviews. I have had people who have not produced a single frame of video come in and tell me about watching their favorite YouTuber and how they know about field of vision and lighting techniques and lower thirds and all the things that they would do if they had the time to do because they're working with their family I admit, I'm excited to admit those people into the program. I also have been in interviews where I turn on the camera, their camera turns on, they see a reflection and immediately say to me, "Oh, I'm so glad you're here. I feel so much better about this interview now."
Yeah.
And I'm saying this because I know that things are changing, but I see it in terms of intake. I'm pushing and working towards it being integrated in terms of curriculum. Because let's say, for example, we ask students on their way in, "Hey, yo, what's your favorite game that you play? What do you like most about it that can relate to this discipline you're going into?" Simple. And this is going to be my next year survey intake for university to find out more so that I can say, listen, 80% of the people that came through to this program, they play this game. And these types of learning things are inside of the games that they're playing obsessively. For your curriculum this year, you may want to consider, and I'll build the curriculum fine. That's fine. That's what my PhD is about as well. But it's more than just representation. It's more than just seeing a mirror. It's about actually meeting somebody where they are. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, because that's something that I also think about too, is like, obviously I've been doing things to make people feel included in my classroom and sort of steering them along the pathway into which they want to create for themselves. Mm. But I'm wondering sometimes, like, is there more I can do before they enter my classroom?
You already do that. I would argue that you already do. You have a public-facing profile. Hungry students, they will look. They will find. They are hungry. We do not give students enough credit, in my view. They know how excited they are about learning. They just need somebody to believe in how excited they are.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it. Like, whoa, you really want to learn some stuff? Yo, I've made several YouTube playlists on my channel to help you get started as a streamer. For example, these are some of the things that I do. I'm sure you do the same thing. They're public lists where you can say, listen, not only am I going to be your teacher, but these are some of the videos that I've consumed to get to where I am. Check them out. They may be helpful to you because I'm telling you they're absolutely helpful for me. They're like, "Oh, how are you doing transitions? Yo, I watched this video. How is your video so well lit?" "Well, I use regular lights." "Huh? Oh yeah. How do you balance your cell phone?" "Well, you can cut a coffee cup in this particular way." "Yep. I watched a YouTube video about it."
Yeah.
Anyway, so these things to let them know that you're identical to them. It's mirrors. Again, it's just mirrors.
People now are trained to be consumers of information, right? And not producers of it. Whereas I feel like we were trying to understand how that information was created. So we were in turn also learning how to be producers of it. I get that end of it. What I'm saying is now, like, for me not to know that I could be a video game designer back then, I may be aware that that's a possibility now.
Because of who
I actually see. Like, I can see a Chris Alexander. I can see my favorite YouTuber or whatever it is. And if they are saying this is how they earn money or a living, that's a possibility for me. Whereas for me, I didn't get to see that. Right. So I'm saying, like, sometimes I wonder how I can help direct them into a stream or a pathway in which they are passionate about. Right.
And but, so go ahead.
No, but they probably also, like, already see it.
Yeah.
Right. It's just maybe how to actually get there.
You know? Yeah, that's real. That's real. And I love your point of they already see it, because I have humans who come at me. They're like, "Yo, I want to make a channel like Jubilee." I'm like, "Yo, that's so powerful." But when they see me react, they're just like, "Oh, this guy already knows who I want to become. Let me listen to him." You know what I'm saying? And if I don't know the channel, in front of them, I'll type in the channel and be like, "Oh, this looks really good. Subscribing." And then it's just like, "Oh, they're going to, oh, he's going to watch what I'm interested in. And of course I'm interested in what you're interested in. You want to learn and I also want to learn. It's a two-way thing." So yeah, I think it's really powerful what you just said, because students are hungry. Many of them know what they want to eat. They just need a little nudge to be like, "Hey, yo, do this and do multiple reps and you'll be fine."
Yeah. So Chris, before I let you go, seeing where you are today, you've talked about some struggles, setbacks you've had, but also a lot of progress. If you were to give students maybe coming up in the same sort of like footsteps as you or similar journey to pursue their goal, what advice would you give them?
Based on my own journey, my dad and I used to argue all the time until the age of 21. And I decided, because I'm a gamer, to try a little experiment. And I didn't tell my dad until a year after. I said, you know what? Let me just assume that my dad and my mom didn't want to have kids to try and run them into the ground. Let me try a whole year. And this is before Shonda Rhimes' Year of Yes, by the way, which I love that book. I was like, let me just try and do exactly what my dad says and see how things go for me. And my mom would always say, Christopher, if you want to know what lies on the road ahead, ask the person coming back. Yeah. And when she said that to me, I was like, oh, she's the person coming back. And so is my dad. Like, yo, there's some wisdom in here. So the advice that I would give is the people that care for you, they actually care for you. I know it's tough to see at times, but they actually do. It wouldn't make sense to help a human into the ground. Now, not all scenarios are the same, but I'm telling you to try and find that love. And the other answer is find your favorite mirror. And a mirror changes whatever stage you are in your life. But there's going to be somebody in this world where you're like, yo, I want to be like them. Because, yo, Victor, Team Spooky, when I saw this guy's technical setup, I was like, man, I want to be like Victor. But what I saw in him was his ability to love something and transform it into a passion. Just find your personal mirror. And it can change. It's fine if it changes. But say like, yo, this person reflects me in terms of work ethic and passion, not in terms of external and riches and all that stuff, because it's the process. The process mirror is what I would say. Just find your process mirror.
Thank you so much, Chris, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak with me about your personal stories, your thoughts, your experiences. I know that someone out there will relate and be affected by this in a positive way. I just want to say that I appreciate everything you do and all the advice and generosity that you've shown me over the last couple of years. It's something that I'll always be grateful for. So if listeners want to connect with you or see some of your work, where can they find you online?
You can find me on YouTube. My gamer tag is PHDigi, PHDigi. And that's the same extension on LinkedIn. You can find me there.
Cool. Or they could just type in video games and your face will just pop up like I do.
Hey, listen, man, I haven't been doing any search engine optimization yet, yo, but that's nice to hear.
You don't have to. You don't save yourself the trouble.
Amazing.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
For show notes and links mentioned in this podcast, visit howdwegetherepodcast.com. To receive updates and new episode releases, subscribe to the podcast and follow me on Instagram and Twitter at edtechxd for all things education and design with wellness in mind. Thanks so much for listening.